Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Exciting stories of the West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Bardell, reading Delilah of the Snows by Harold Bisbal. Chapter 4, Ledger's Responsibility. Ledger was paler than usual, as well as breathless and very dusty, when he flung himself down in a dilapidated armchair in Ingleby's room. The window was open, for it was very hot, and Ingleby, who stood near it, appeared to be listening intently to the patter of feet that came up from the narrow street, until he moved forward and laid his hand upon the sash. Then Ledger laughed hollowly. "I don't think that's necessary, and I wish you would leave it as it is just now," he said. "Considering that you live on the fourth story, they're scarcely likely to come in that way." "I did it without thinking," said Ingleby, who turned to him a trifle flushed in face. "You're looking faint. I can get you some water. Fortunately, it's cheap." "I'll be all right in a minute or two," and Ledger made a little deprecatory gesture. "I'm not sure I ever made 4 miles quite so fast before. And the blow I got from that fellow's dog whip, the handle end, must have shaken me. Never mind the water." Ingleby sat down a trifle limply, and unconscious of the fact that his own clothes were badly torn, gazed at his companion. Ledger's dusty disarray heightened the effect of his pallor, and his hair, dank with perspiration, lay smeared upon his forehead, while there was a big discolored bruise upon one cheek. They had come home across the meadow and through the woodland instead of by the road, and neither of them remembered how many hedges and thickets they had scrambled through, since the one thing apparent was the advisability of escaping attention. "We made an excellent pace," Ingleby said. "I scarcely think that the others can have got here yet. They hadn't the same necessity for haste. Still, I'm almost afraid it was wasted energy. You see, the police wouldn't be very long in tracing us." "I don't suppose so. That big military-looking fellow meant to make sure of me. No doubt he'll send a groom over with our description. He seemed to recognize you, too." Ingleby rose abruptly and leaned against the mantel with his lips firmly set. It was several moments before he spoke again. "I think he did," he said. "In fact, I'd have done almost anything sooner than have had this happen. Though that doesn't matter now. There's a more important question, and it has to be faced." They looked at each other in silence for a second or two, and both their faces were very grim, with a shadow of fear in them. They were young and shrank from the contemplation of what it seemed had been done. The thing was horrible in itself, quite apart from the consequences, which promised to be disastrous. "You mean," said Ledger very quietly, "is he dead?" Ingleby made a little gesture, and once more for almost a minute the heavy silence was intensified by the ticking of his watch and the sounds in the street below. Both of them listened intently, almost expecting to hear the tramp of heavy feet upon the stairway. "Heaven forbid," said Ingleby a trifle hoarsely. "Still, he looked horribly like it. There's just one thing of which I should like to be quite certain." "Of course," said Ledger, and met his companion's gaze. "Suppose I told you I did it, would it separate us?" "No," said Ingleby, "you know that. It might have been I, and anyway, we were both in the thing." "Then, as you suppose, the military man was mistaken. I had nothing in my hands and never even reached him." Ingleby, in spite of his protestations, drew a deep breath of relief, but Ledger, who appeared to be recovering now, smiled. "Well," he said, "you're satisfied, but it doesn't in the least affect the position. You see, the military gentleman, who appeared certain he saw me strike the blow, and I scarcely think my word would go very far against his with a usual kind of jury." "You know who did it?" Ledger smiled curiously. "I do, but you ought to understand that the fact isn't of much use to me."
"You mean..."
"I could plead not guilty, but I couldn't point out the man responsible. You see, I induced him to join the society and gave him the Americans' pamphlets. I believe the more virulent ones. They seem to make a strong impression on him. One can't well back out of his responsibility, especially when the adversary is always ready to make the most of the opportunity. Besides, the man has a family." Ingleby clenched one hand.
"And you have Hetty."
"Yes," said Ledger with an impressive quietness, "and Hetty has only me. Still, one must do what he feels he has to."
"But you can't leave Hetty. And what would happen to her if you were..."
"If I were in jail?" And Ledger's face went awry. "She would be turned out of her berth to a certainty. It didn't quite strike me until you put the thing before me. There's the lad's mother, too. A little horrible, isn't it? How long does one usually get for manslaughter?"
Again there was silence, save for Ingleby's groan. Democratic aspirations were very well as subjects for discussion, but now that he was brought face to face with the results of attempting to realize them, they appalled him. He did not remember that usually very little worth the having can be obtained without somebody's getting hurt, and it would have afforded him no great consolation if he had remembered, since for the time being he had had quite enough of theories, and he made a little abrupt gesture.
"Tom," he said, "what dolts we are! The thing is perfectly simple. You have only to come out with me, and the fact that you've made a bolt of it will be quite enough to divert suspicion from the other man."
"There is a difficulty. Steamboat fares cost money, and I'm not sure Hetty and I have £5 in the treasury."
Ingleby laughed almost lightheartedly.
"I think I have enough to take us all out at the cheapest rates, and you must let me lend it to you, if only to prove what you believe in isn't an impracticable fancy."
Ledger slowly straightened himself.
"I don't want to be ungracious, but it's a difficult thing to do. The money's yours, and you'd have nothing left."
Ingleby laid a hand on his shoulder and gripped it hard. "Are you willing to see your sister cast adrift to save your confounded pride? The fact that she has a relative undergoing penal servitude isn't much of a recommendation to a girl who has to earn her bread. Besides, like a good many of us, you're not logical. You thought you had a claim on Esmond's property." There was a light step on the stairway, and he stopped suddenly.
"There's Hetty," he said. "We'll leave it to her."
The door swung open, and the girl came in, gasping with horror in her eyes.
"Oh," she said, "it's awful. They've come in with the wagonettes, and Harry told me. How did it happen?"
"Sit down," said Ingleby gently. "Tom will explain." Ledger did so concisely, and Hetty clutched the armchair hard as she listened to him. Still young as she was, she held herself in hand and sat very still, with the color ebbing from her face.
"What shall we do?" she said.
"Ingleby has asked us to go out to Canada with him. He offers to lend us the money."
The girl's face flushed suddenly, and she glanced at Ingleby, who appeared embarrassed.
"How much will you have left if you do that?" she asked.
"I don't know yet. Anyway, it doesn't matter. If you make any silly objections, Hetty, Tom will go to jail."
The girl turned to her brother, with the crimson still in her cheek and her lips quivering. and it suddenly struck Ingleby that she was really remarkably pretty, although that appeared of no great moment just then.
"That would happen, Tom," she said.
"Yes," said Ledger quietly, "I believe it would."
Hetty turned again and looked at Ingleby with a curious intentness.
"You are quite sure you want us?"
Ingleby, moved by an impulse he did not understand, caught and held fast one of her hands.
"Hetty," he said, "aren't we old friends? There is nobody I would sooner take with me, but we shall certainly quarrel if you ask me a question of that kind again."
The girl's expression perplexed him, and with a sudden movement, she drew her hand away.
"Well," she said, "we will come. I would stay, only I know Tom would not go without me. But whatever happens, we will pay you back the money."
"I don't think you want to be unpleasant, Hetty," said Ingleby. "Anyway, you have only about an hour in which to get ready, because if we're not off by the next train, it's quite likely that we shall not have the opportunity for going at all. Get what you want together and meet us behind the booking office on the main line platform. Tom and I will take the back way to the station."
Hetty turned and went without a word, and Ledger looked at his companion.
"I don't think she meant to hurt you, but what she did mean exactly is a good deal more than I understand," he said.
Ingleby made a little impatient gesture.
"I don't suppose it matters. Girls seem to have curious fancies. In the meantime, it might be as well if we made a start. I'll lend you a decent jacket, and as you had a cap on it, it would be advisable to take my straw hat. To carry out the same notion, I'll slip on my one dark suit. They usually make a point of mentioning one's clothes."
They were ready in about 10 minutes.
But when they had descended the long stairway, Ingleby stopped in the dingy hall and stood still a moment, irresolute.
"If it wasn't for the harpy downstairs, we might get clear away before anybody was aware that we had gone," he said. "I can't leave her what I owe her either, for one never does seem to have change when he wants it. How much have you got on you?"
"Handful of copper," said Ledger with a little grim smile. Ingleby appeared to reflect.
"I could send her the few shillings from wherever we stop. The post office people obligingly stamp every envelope with the name of the place it comes from. I don't think we want to leave a trail behind us."
Ingleby stood still a moment longer with a flush in his face.
"Nothing would stop that woman's talking, not even a gag. It's horribly unfortunate."
"It usually is," and Ledger looked at him with a curious little smile. "The worst of having a propaganda is that people who haven't any get indignant when one doesn't live up to it. They naturally lay part of the blame on the fallacies he believes in."
Ingleby swung round.
"I'd sooner face a battery, but I'm going down."
He disappeared down the basement steps, and in another minute, a harsh voice, apparently vituperating him, rose up, and when he rejoined his comrade, his face was redder than ever.
"Now," he said, "we'll go, the sooner the better. Everybody in the neighborhood will know what she thinks of me inside of 10 minutes.
They slipped out into the street, and Ingleby stopped a moment at the end of it and looked back with a curious expression in his face. The sunlight that lay bright upon one side of it emphasized its unattractiveness. Tall houses, grim in their squalid ugliness, shut it in, and the hot air that scarcely stirred between them was heavy with the sour odors from a neighboring tanyard. A hoarse clamor and a woman's voice, high-pitched and shrill with fear or anger, came out of a shadowy alley where unkempt children played in the gutter. The uproar did not concern them. They were apparently used to it.
"I've lived 5 years in the middle of this, and now I'm almost sorry to leave it," he said. "There's no reason in us."
Then he turned again with a little resolute shake of his shoulders.
Well, we've done it at last. If half of what one hears is true, there is a chance for such as us in the country we are going to. Ledger said nothing, and it was silently they threaded their way deviously in and out of alleys and archways toward the station. Their life had been a hard one in that squalid town, but the place had after all been home, and they could not tell what awaited them in the unknown. They had in them the steadfastness which is born of struggle, but the unthinking courage of youth that has felt no care is quite a different thing. However, nobody appeared desirous of preventing their departure, and they eventually got away by a steamer, for which they had to wait several days in Liverpool. In the meantime, Geoffrey Esmond lay one evening, propped up against the pillows, in a darkened room at Holtcar Grange. He was blanched in face, and his eyes were heavy, while a big wet bandage was still rolled about his head. Major Colthurst was by his bedside, and a burly sergeant of police sat on the very edge of a sofa with a notebook in his hand. The window was open behind the blind, and a little cool air that brought the fragrance of flowers with it crept into the room. Major Colthurst fancied he could recognize the man who assaulted you, Mr. Esmond, and I have no doubt we will lay hands on him in a day or two, said the officer. If you could identify him, too, it would make the thing more certain, and I would like to read you the description furnished me before we go any farther.
If that is the usual course, I don't see why I should object, said Esmond dryly. Still, isn't it a trifle suggestive?
The sergeant did not appear to notice the irony of the inquiry, and launched out into what was, in the circumstances, a tolerably accurate description of Ledger. Esmond listened quietly with a little smile in his half-closed eyes.
Major Colthurst, he said, is evidently astonishingly quick-sighted, if he saw all that.
I'm not sure I understand you, Esmond, and Colthurst looked up sharply.
Well, said the young man reflectively, I always fancied you were a sportsman, and we had our fun. Of course, while it lasted, I would cheerfully have broken the socialist fellow's head if I could have managed it, but just now the odds seem a trifle heavy against him.
Colthurst laughed a little, but the sergeant shook his head.
That's not at all the way to look at it, sir, he said. In a case of this kind, one has, if I may point it out, a duty to society.
And the police, said Esmond, who made a little gesture. I really do not think I should ask the opinion of the latter as to what is incumbent on me. Still, that is scarcely the point. You want me to identify the man, and I can't do it.
You must have seen him close to, sir, Esmond laughed. Have you ever had incipient concussion of the brain? You probably haven't. I believe they line your headgear with cork or cane. Well, in one respect, it's a little unfortunate, since it would have helped you to understand my position. Now, the major says the man's hair was light brown, but so far as I can remember, it was red.
Are you quite sure it wasn't Colthurst?
Colthurst appeared reflective.
He certainly had his hat on. A cap, sir, said the sergeant.
Esmond glanced at the major reproachfully.
You will notice, sergeant, how reliable he is. The fact mentioned wouldn't prevent your seeing what kind of man he was, said the sergeant tartly. He is described as little and pale and of a delicate appearance.
Then if the blow on my head is anything to go by, I really think
my friend was mistaken, said Esmond. It's in my firm opinion the man was distinctly muscular.
The sergeant stood up and closed his book.
The affair is a serious one, and we naturally look to a gentleman of your position for—
Esmond stopped him with a gesture, and a little languid smile under which, however, the burly sergeant flushed.
As I mentioned, there are matters in which it is hardly the province of the police to instruct me, he said. I'm sorry, I can't do anything more for you today, Sergeant, but if you were to come round and my head has settled down a little, I might be able to recollect the fellow's appearance rather more distinctly.
If we were to lay hands on him, we must have a warrant at once.
Then, if it depends on me, I am very much afraid you will not get it. And now, as my doctor insists on quietness, you will excuse me. Can you reach the bell, Major?
The sergeant went out fuming inwardly, and Colthurst laughed.
I'm not quite sure that I should have let the fellow off, he said. What made you do it?
I really don't know, and scarcely think it matters, said Edmund languidly. Still, you see, I fancy we went a little farther than the law would sanction, and that being so, one could scarcely expect the other fellow to pay for everything. Now, if I might remind you, Miss Colthurst was kind enough to promise to come in and talk to me.
Join me next week on the Sagebrush Trail for more exciting Western adventure in Delilah of the Snows by Harold Binlaws.